Shalom, Hadavarnix. Welcome to our next session of The Romans and Russians Are Coming. Oh my. This is session number 6. This session can also be viewed on the class, the first regathering, Modern Israel, and that it will be session 49 of the first regathering. All right, before we get into the new material, let's take a look at where we were last session, in session 5. In session 5, we learned that there would be a massive invasion from the north against Israel. And in your map here, you can see Israel at the bottom of the map. At the top of the map, you see Russia. The invasion would come from the uttermost parts of the north. And Russia, the Russia panhandle, comes down at this point, as close to Israel as it can get, and just north of the Caucasus Mountains. And anyway, it will appear that Russia will gather a coalition of forces to attack in some other direction, a military activity going in some other direction. But to the surprise of everyone, God will put hooks in the jaws of Gog, the leader of Russia, and will bring him south against little Israel. The number of paths that could be taken south to Israel, he could go through Georgia and Turkey and Syria. I'm sure that the path could lead through Azerbaijan, through Persia, through Iraq or Turkey and Syria. There's a number of routes that could be taken by the allies of Russia. But the point will be that there will be a surprise attack and Russia will move south, to the surprise of everybody, against little Israel. Now, the major coalition partners are named: Persia, modern Iran; Kush, northern Sudan; Put, that's either Somalia or Libya. We're not sure which nation would be more accurately biblically identified as Put. Also, Gomer, possibly Germany or possibly the Ukraine, and then Togarma in the area of Armenia or Turkey. And then, of course, it's mentioned, speaking of Togarma in particular, that the invasion would come from the north. And we know that the invasion will come from the uttermost parts of the north due to other sections of Scripture. And due north of Israel is Russia. And here's a map of Russia. And if you go Israel, you can see Israel in the bottom left corner here. If you go due north from Jerusalem, you run smack dab into Moscow, the capital of Russia. And then if you continue north from then on, it's Russia all the way to the Arctic Circle, all the way to the Arctic Oceans. As far as you can go, the uttermost parts of the north is Russia. Now, the object of the invasion appears to be the mountains of Israel. The mountains of Israel are in the West Bank today, the occupied West Bank. But they are called the mountains of Israel. They're not called the mountains of Palestine or the mountains of anything else. These are the mountains of Israel. And so this appears to be the object of the invasion. Now, the land that is invaded is described in various terms. It's described as a land that's been a desolation for many years. And here's an example of the desolation of the Judean hills in the years past. This is the Hill of Evil Counsel, just south of Jerusalem in 1894. Just a desolate wilderness. The invading army, the invading coalition, is described as being huge, a dark storm cloud over the whole land, portrayed in this picture here. Now, this prophecy could not have been fulfilled before 1948, because there was no state of Israel in 1948. And this is the Palestine Post with the very famous headlines, "The State of Israel is Born," Sunday, May 14th, 1948. Again, the land is desolate. Here's another picture of the desolation of the land of Israel in the late 1860s when Mark Twain visited the area. This is the Mount Tabor that he saw. Again, hardly anyone living in the land, just a dry desolation. The land is described as being filled with people who've come from many nations. And the Jewish people have come back to our land from 80 to 90 different nations. The land is described as confident, and this is reflected in the comments of my friend Moshe on the airplane. He said, "We did it. We have the power." Moshe was very, very confident that Israel could defeat her enemies. The land is also described as prospering. And we see that Gog comes against the land of Israel for the purpose of economic gain. He views Israel as a ripe, juicy berry ready to be plucked. So that's where we ended up last week with verse 12. So at this point, let's move on to verse 13. And in verse 13, we see there is a protest raised against this invasion. It's revealed that a group of nations will protest this invasion. Ezekiel 38:13. Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish, with all its villages, will say to you, "Have you come to capture spoil? Have you assembled your company to seize plunder, to carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, and to capture great spoil?" Now, the protesters are identified as Sheba. Sheba was the grandson of Abraham through Keturah in Genesis 25:3. Sheba is located in Saudi Arabia, or maybe it'd be better to say the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, and a better identification of Sheba would be Yemen. Yemen in the very, very southern tip of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. So this is Sheba, ancient Sheba. Dedan is then mentioned, another grandson of Abraham through Keturah in Genesis 25:3. Dedan is located in Saudi Arabia. It's a tribe located in the Arabian Peninsula. The third protester is revealed to be the merchants of Tarshish. Now, there are three possible locations of Tarshish. Tarshish was a Phoenician trading colony, and there were a number of them along the Atlantic. Now, the first one would have been on the west coast of Africa, but this is not very likely. Another Tarshish is in England, to the north, up in Europe there. That is a reasonable possibility. But the most probable Tarshish is the one located in Spain. That's most likely the Tarshish that Ezekiel is referring to. And point D, the merchants of Tarshish object, "with all the young lions thereof." Now, this is a Hebrew idiom for the nations which arose out of Tarshish. Well, what nations arose out of these areas? Well, in Africa, the Tarshish in Africa spawned no nation, so we can rule out the African Tarshish. However, the Tarshish, the Phoenician trading colony located in England, is a good possibility because England spawned the nations of North America, Canada, the United States, Australia as well, and the British Commonwealth of Nations. So those could be the young nation, the young lions of Tarshish located in England or the northern up in the United Kingdom there. But Spain as well is a strong possibility because the nation of Spain colonized a lot of the nations in South America, in the Caribbean, and in Central America. So there were definitely nations spawned from the Tarshish in the United Kingdom and in Spain. Now, based on previous references then, the most likely candidate for the Tarshish that Ezekiel is talking about is the Tarshish of Spain on our map here, and then the young lions of Central and South America, with the strong possibility that the United States and the British Commonwealth and Canada might protest as well. We'll have to see exactly how this works out if we get to see this invasion in our lifetime. All right, what is the protest? What do they say to Gog? Well, they have Gog all figured out. They say, have you come to take spoil? Well, the spoil, word there, spoils, means the spoils of war. Have you come to get economic gain through warfare? Next rhetorical question, I believe. Have you assembled your company to take prey? Now, this word prey means to plunder through military victory. So not only is Gog interested in economic gain, the spoils of war? He's also interested in the prestige of a military victory over Israel. And of course, Israel has won all the wars she's been involved in. So there would be a bit of prestige gained from Gog saying, we finally crushed Israel when nobody else was able to do it. So they get military prestige. The third question asked of Gog is, to carry away silver and gold? And those references to silver and gold simply mean to gain financial riches. Do you want to gain financial riches as well as economic, general economic gain? And finally, to take away cattle and goods. And again, these two comments on cattle and goods simply mean to gain material riches. Cattle and goods were material riches for the people in that day and age, just as silver and gold was materially financial riches. So point A, the final question, to take great spoil. And this is the real aim. This is the real aim of Gog, to gain national wealth and prominence. To gain wealth and prominence. All right, let's take a look at some observations. Point three in your outline. Dedan and Sheba, representing the Semitic nations, the Arabs, will not favor the Russian invasion, nor apparently will South American nations. And this could possibly include the United States and the United Kingdom. Now, it's very interesting that Semitic nations, the Arabs, apparently will not favor this invasion. You would think they would. But according to the text here, it looks like they do not. Secondly, second observation, the protesters recognize that Russia invades for her own self-interest. No matter what her stated reason may be, she invades for her own self-interest. Now, these protesters raise a big verbal ruckus and maybe even do some threats, but they do not move beyond the protest stage. Now, that's an important point to note, the bottom of your notes. Point C, mark it up. They do not go beyond the protest stage. They are either unable or unwilling to do anything more than voice disapproval. They do not stand in the gap in a physical, practical way to side with Israel. All right, let's go on to verses 14 through 16, which now describe the invasion itself. Verse 14 begins with God's challenge to Gog. Therefore prophesy, son of man, he's speaking to Ezekiel there, and say to Gog, thus says the Lord God, on that day when my people Israel are living securely, will you not know it? So Ezekiel is to speak directly unto Gog. By the way, this introduces a new section. And God says, in that day, my people will be dwelling securely. Will you not know it? In other words, Gog has studied the Israeli situation very carefully. He's looked it over, and he sees that Israel is prosperous and complacent and off their guard. They have let their guard down. Aha! Now, he feels the time is ripe for this invasion. And you know, this has happened before. Israel has become complacent other times in the past as well, prosperous and complacent. In fact, it happened right before the 1973 Yom Kippur War. In the book, A History of Israel by Howard M. Sachar, page 740, you read this interesting excerpt. There is peace on the banks of the canal and the Sinai Desert, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, Judea, Samaria, and on the Golan. The lines are safe, the bridges are open, Jerusalem is united. In other words, we are secure. New settlements have been established, and our political position is stable. This is the result of a balanced, bold, and far-sighted policy. You know that only the labor alignment could have accomplished this. And Howard Sachar comments on those paragraphs. He says, in anticipation of elections to the 8th Knesset, these bold-faced and self-congratulatory labor placards greeted citizens from kiosks and wallboards in every town and city of Israel. they expressed a quite genuine public mood of national security, confidence. Prosperity and confidence. Israel let her guard down, and Egypt and Syria attacked, and Jordan attacked, excuse me, Egypt and Syria attacked in the 73 Yom Kippur War. This has happened before. Israel's complacency and relaxation of her security concerns will be the trigger that convinces Gog that he can attack. So in verse 15, we get the departure of his coalition from the north. Verse 15 of chapter 38. You will come from your place out of the remote parts of the north, you and many peoples with you, all of them riding on horses, a great assembly, a mighty army. So you will come out of your place out of the uttermost parts of the north. Now this is not limited to Togarma, as verse 6 implied. The uttermost parts of the north are far to the north of Israel. Here is Russia, far to the north of Israel, all the way to the Arctic Oceans. So the armies, the military forces of Gog, will gather with the rest of the coalition, probably in the panhandle of southern Russia. And from the uttermost parts of the north, they will come down against the little nation of Israel. Now, the confederacy is described. You, that's Gog and Magog, many peoples with you, those are his allies. That is the coalition described in terms that Ezekiel and his contemporaries can understand. It's a great company, a mighty army. And again, horses and mules are not that far distant from modern warfare. You know, they were still in use in World War I. So again, these are terms that Ezekiel and his contemporaries and those that would follow him for the next 2,400 years or so could understand. This is a literal, well-equipped military force. Again, described in the terms of 500 BC. All right, in verse 16, we come to the arrival of the coalition in Israel. Verse 16. And you will come up against my people Israel like a cloud to cover the land. It shall come about in the last days that I will bring you against my land, so that the nations may know me when I am sanctified through you before their eyes, O Gog. Now notice, God calls the Jewish people my people in verse 16. You will come up against my people Israel. Israel is God's people, even in unbelief. Mark this section of your notes, okay? This is happening during the first regathering in unbelief. And still, Israel and the Jewish people are called God's people. The word Israel there is not a reference to the church. As your replacement theologian might have you believe, it is a reference to literal physical Israel. It is not an allegorical reference to the church. So even, and the replacement theologian will tell you that Israel has rejected God, and so God has rejected Israel, and that is not the case. Verse 16 lays that mistake to rest. Let me say it one more time. Even in unbelief, in verse 16, God calls the nation and the people of Israel, my people Israel, my people. All right, enough on that. He states that the invasion will come like a cloud covering the land. So again, the massiveness of the invasion is repeated. The same picture is repeated of a massive, massive cloud covering the land. And here's another picture I picked up on the internet. I think is a good illustration of that. Here this massive storm cloud goes clear to the horizon. Clear to the horizon. Now the time, the time of the invasion is stated to stated that it will be in the latter days or the last days. So this speaks of eschatological times, the end of the age. It will occur at the end of the age. Then God says, I will bring you against my land, my people, and my land. Two key points here. First of all, it is God's land, ultimately. God's land. He's the one who owns the land. He's the one who owns the world. Not only the little notch of land called Israel. And he can do anything he wants with his property. Secondly, this speaks of the divine side of the invasion. God is bringing this invasion about. That's the divine side of the invasion. It is, I am bringing you against my land. Now, why is God doing this? Well, his purpose is next brought out. We learn the reason why he's doing this, that the nations may know me, that the Gentiles may realize who is God indeed. Now, this tells us that atheism will receive a severe blow as a result of the outcome of this invasion. Also, idolatry will be devastated. So the world, the Gentiles, many of the Gentiles will come to realize that the God, the living God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is the one who is in charge of this world, not some idol, and atheism will be squished. The means that God will use to cause the nations to know him and finally come to grips with his reality. The means, when I shall be sanctified in you, O Gog, before their eyes. In other words, God is going to be set apart by what he's going to do to Gog, what he's going to do to his massive military coalition. God is going to be set apart as special and holy. That's what sanctified means, to be set apart for special use. And so this whole invasion is set apart by God to glorify himself to the nations of the world. So please observe that God's plan is never limited strictly to Israel. God's plan, God's purpose in this world is worldwide in nature. It's always designed to present his glory and his grace to the entire world. All right, some observations. Dr. Fruchtenbaum makes some observations. Point 4A. There is an initial success and the invaders enter the land. So here is the map of Israel again. That's the mountains of Israel, the West Bank. And so there is initial success as the invaders apparently reach the mountains of Israel. Secondly, we've looked at the divine side of the invasion. God is going to bring it about. But we also see a human side to the invasion. So while Gog has his purpose, that's the human side, to take spoil, God has his purpose to be set apart as holy among the Gentiles, to be sanctified among the Gentiles. So that's the divine side. There's a human side and a divine side working together to bring about God's plan for this world. Again, this is an example of God's sovereignty and man's free will and how they work together. And to many Westerners, this appears to be a paradox. But you need to learn to love paradox. Why? Because the fingerprints of paradox are all over the Bible. It's all over the Bible. So don't fight over the issue of paradox, especially the issue of God's sovereignty and man's free will. Here's another railroad track picture. Remember what I talked about? That the railroad train has to run on two tracks to get to its destination. And God has designed that there are two tracks. There's God's sovereignty and man's free will. And the two work together to bring about God's plan. But many Westerners can't handle this so-called dichotomy, this so-called contradiction, this paradox. And they want to drift from one side or the other. And so one side will say, this track, the right side, guides the train. It's the most important track. And the other side will say, no, 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 no. There are other verses in the Bible that say, this track, the left-hand track, guides the train. And then the two sides will get into a nice theological argument. No, this track, No, this trek. No, this trek. And then one side calls the other a heretic. You heretic. And they seem to have forgotten the fact that the railroad ties hold these two parallel tracks together. And it is God who holds all this together. He set it up this way. He's designed it. Just the way a railroad track is deliberately designed. God designed it to work this way. He holds it all together. It will work because he's in charge. So we puny humans don't have to worry about figuring it all out. Just learn to love paradox. Paradox shows you that God is a lot bigger than you or me, because he can handle all that. You know, it's really like watching this class. Maybe I can be a little more personal there. It's really like watching this class. You know, you made a deliberate, responsible decision to come and watch this class. But that didn't catch God by surprise. He knew you would be here. He knew you would be here. He knew you'd be observing this. So his sovereignty is at work. The fact that he knows everything that goes on. Yet you made a responsible decision. So the paradox exists in every moment of our lives. Men make responsible decisions, and yet God is totally in charge. All right, enough of that. Enough of that. Just learn to love paradox, okay? All right, let's turn to point F and verses 17 through 23, where we come to the destruction of the invaders. Verse 17 begins with a declaration and an accusation. Verse 17 of chapter 38 of Ezekiel. Thus says the Lord God, are you the one of whom I spoke in former days through my servants, the prophets of Israel, who prophesied in those days for many years that I would bring you against them? Are you he of whom I spoke in olden times? Now, God is not asking for information here. He knows exactly what's going on. This statement is rhetorical. God doesn't need Gog to tell him anything. In fact, God prophesied in those days for many years that I would bring you against them. So he knows exactly what's going on. This is rhetorical. Now, God refers to previous prophecies here. Now, nothing in the writing in prophets spoke of an invasion from Gog, except this section here in Ezekiel. Yet God speaks in the plural, prophets. Why? Well, actually, no one knows. There are some various thoughts brought forth. Perhaps this was prophesied by vocal prophets who did not record their prophecies, such as Elijah and Elisha and Enoch. That would probably be our best bet, that verbal prophets spoke of this invasion, not writing prophets. But this invasion had been prophesied before through some means, and God had spoken earlier that it would come about. All right, there's a declaration and an accusation in verse 17. Then God moves to a judgment in verses 18 and the first part of verse 19. It will come about on that day, when Gog comes against the land of Israel, declares the Lord God, that my fury will mount up in my anger and my zeal and in my blazing wrath. So the invasion comes against God's land. So the invasion is anti-Israel. It's against the land promise. It wants to destroy the land promise of the Abrahamic covenant. It's also against God's people. That means it's anti-Semitic. In other words, this invasion wants to destroy the nation promise of the Abrahamic covenant. So God is coming, so Gog is coming against the land and against the people, against God's land and against God's people, and so God's wrath is aroused. And so this invasion against God's people and God's land will cause God to move for two reasons. First of all, God's jealousy. Now, this is jealousy in the good sense. We often think of jealousy as negative. But there is a good sense to the idea of jealousy. It's the sense of the right of protection and the exercise of ownership. You see, Gog here is trying to violate, he's trying to destroy the wife of the Lord. Israel is the wife of the Lord. And God moves out to protect his wife, protect his beloved in jealousy. Now here are some verses that speak of Israel being the wife of the Lord, wife of Yahweh. Jeremiah 31, 31 and 32. Behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant which I made with their forefathers, with their fathers in the day I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. My covenant which they broke, although I was what? I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. So there's the picture, one picture of Israel being the wife of the Lord. Also Isaiah 54:5. For your husband is your maker, whose name is the Lord of hosts, and your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel, who is called the God of the whole earth. So God moves out in jealousy to protect his wife. And God's wrath is his fierce, fierce anger. His fierce anger. And now this is the cursing aspect of the Abrahamic covenant. You know, he's going to destroy this invader based on Genesis 12:3. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. So Gog is moving out to curse the Jewish people, curse the land of Israel, and so God's fierce anger will destroy him. All right, that brings us to your break. And we'll pick it up in the second part of verse 19 as we come to the means by which God will use to destroy the invader. So take your break. Be back in about 15 minutes. All right, we're back. We're back from our break. So let's move on to verses 19, the second half of verse 19 to verse 22, where God describes the means of the destruction of Gog's army. The first tool that God uses is earthquake in verse 19, second half of verse 19, and into verse 20. So let's start with the shaking described in the second part of verse 19. I declare that on that day there will surely be a great earthquake in the land of Israel. So in that day, the day of the invasion, God is going to shake the land of Israel. The results are found in verse 20. The fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, the beasts of the field, all the creeping things that creep on the earth, and all the men who are on the face of the earth will shake at my presence. The mountains also will be thrown down, the steep pathways will collapse, and every wall will fall to the ground. In fact, in verses 20 and 21, we're going to see three results of this earthquake. So in verse 20, first of all, we see the results of the earthquake upon life. And he speaks of the fishes of the sea, the birds of the air, the beasts of the field, and the creeping things of the earth. So all the creatures living in the land of Israel are terrified. He's talking about the land of Israel here. So the fishes of the sea would be the fish in the Sea of Galilee. Now, can animals anticipate and shake in the presence of an earthquake? Well, interestingly enough, I ran across this article in November 2003 by the National Geographic Society, and the author writes, "Can animals sense earthquakes?" And here's what Marianne Mott, the author, writes. "The belief that animals can predict earthquakes has been around for centuries. In 373 BC, and of course this is only 200 years after Ezekiel actually wrote this, in 373 BC, historians recorded that animals, including rats, snakes, and weasels, those are creeping things that creep along the earth, or they're beasts of the field, whatever you want to call them there, rats, snakes, and weasels deserted the Greek city of Helis in droves just days before a quake devastated the place." So they noticed some anxiety on the part of the, and a reaction by the animals. Accounts of similar animal anticipation of earthquakes have surfaced across the centuries since. Catfish, There's some fish in the sea, and there's catfish in the Sea of Galilee. Catfish moving violently. Chickens stop laying eggs. Bees leaving their hive in a panic have been reported. Countless pet owners claim to have witnessed their cats and dogs acting strangely before the ground shook, barking or whining for no apparent reason, or showing signs of nervousness and restlessness. And so animals can indeed fear earthquakes. And that's exactly what's going to happen in verse 20. The fishes, the birds, the beasts, the creeping things are all going to be terrified as they sense this earthquake coming, and probably during the midst of it. Then he says, all men on the that are upon the face of the earth. Now that rendering earth, if it's rendered that way in your version, seems to be a bit too strong. The word is not aretz, but the word is adama, which would be better rendered, I think, land, not planet earth. But this is a local earthquake. This is in the land of Israel. So this word adama speaks of the ground, the dust, the dirt, the soil. And you know, Israel is in an earthquake-prone zone. In fact, Israel is the very northern arm of the Great Rift Valley. I think this is the largest earthquake fault on Earth. You see the Great Rift Valley down in Africa, but the Gulf of Aden then on the right side of the map and the Red Sea on the left side of the map are part of this earthquake fault. And it splits in two right at the Sinai Peninsula, and the western branch goes up into Egypt. The eastern branch goes north and becomes the Jordan Valley. This is the northern branch of the very end of the Great Rift Valley. It's an earthquake-prone zone. And you can see the effects of earthquakes in the past at a little place called Moktesh Katan, the small crater. It's located in this area in the Jordan Valley. And we visited on one of my one of the trips I was privileged to take to Israel. Here is the walls, the mountains surrounding Moktesh Katan. You can see that they have been pushed up. They have been pushed up from the center. Now, we're driving along the road, and we're going to go through this pass through this mountains that have been pushed up. So let's drive over to the pass. Here we are, right by it. You can see the road in the bottom right corner of the photograph, but there you can see the earth, how it has been pushed up from the right side there, and almost into a vertical position, almost a vertical position. Now we're in the middle of the pass, and you can see the great curvature that has been forced upon these layers of rock and dirt as it was pushed up. Quite an amazing seismic evidence there, evidence of seismic activity. Now let's turn 180 degrees and look on the other side of the pass. And there again, you can see how the layers on the earth that were level at one time have now been shoved up almost to a vertical position. Quite an amazing seismic event. Now this is Moktesh Katan as a close-up. And the little pass that we went through is located right down here in this area of Moktesh Katan. And you can see that all around Moktesh Katan, the earth has been pushed up as a result of this seismic activity. Now, Jerusalem, of course, then lies in a seismic-rich zone, and it has been discovered that an earthquake fault runs right through the Mount of Olives. And you can see on this map, the Mount of Olives is on the right side of the map, but there's this earthquake fault running through the Mount of Olives just south of the temple and the old city. And of course, Zechariah 14:4 speaks of the Mount of Olives splitting in two, part of it moving north and part of it moving south, where that is very literally possible. Now, this is a Google Earth view of the same area. To the right in the red circle is the Temple Mount and the Old City. That's the Temple Mount. Now this is the Mount of Olives in this large red circle here. And this is the Kidron Valley between the Temple Mount and the Mount of Olives. And right here is that earthquake fault. And of course, you can't see it as it runs underneath the Mount of Olives, but you can at least see the fact that it runs directly into the Mount of Olives, just a little bit south of the Temple and the Temple Mount. Now, to the top of the map, you see a red circle, and I took this the next photograph from this viewpoint. This is a viewpoint, and I aimed my camera across the road at the earthquake fault. So that's the direction of view. And here we are. Now, this is probably the Valley of Jehoshaphat that God talks about, where he will judge all nations. I really think that this is a strong candidate for the Valley of Jehoshaphat. Right now, it's a very shallow valley, but it is an earthquake fault. And if it expands to move the Mount of Olives and break it in two, north and south, it will be quite deeper than it is right now. So there's the earthquake fault. Now I'm going to turn my camera a little to the right, and now you can see the road. And to the right, you can see the Mount of Olives coming down just south of us. And again, here is that earthquake fault, the good candidate for the Valley of Jehoshaphat. Now I'm going to focus in on I'm going to zoom in on this section. You can see the road at the bottom and on the left, the Mount of Olives coming up on the right. And there's that earthquake fault running directly into the Mount of Olives. So this is a very, very earthquake prone area, and it can affect Jerusalem very, very severely. Now, this earthquake, point B in your outline there, is upon the land of Israel. It's not worldwide. This is limited to Israel. And it says here that the mountains will be thrown down, so there's seismic movement that affects the Judean hills and maybe some of the other upthrusts in Israel. The steep places shall fall. That is probably a reference to landslides, very common when we have strong earthquakes. And then point three says, every wall shall fall to the ground. The word there is homah, and these are not walls of buildings, but this is a reference to city walls, protective city walls. And so we learn now that the ancient wall around the old city will probably be one of the walls that collapse. And here we're on the Mount of Olives looking at the Temple Mount, and there's the ancient wall. That is a combination of Crusader and Arab construction. That wall could very well fall to the ground. Here's a look at the southern end of the Temple Mount. You can see the walls of the old walls of Jerusalem, the ancient city walls there. They will probably come tumbling down. Now, this is a picture of the wall that supports the southern end of the Temple Mount. It's part of the platform that Herod the Great built to support the southern end of the Temple Mount. And when the Muslims decided to make a mosque in the area called Solomon's Stables, that's just a part of the area that upholds the temple platform using architectural construction. It's been called Solomon's Stables. But anyway, they decided to clear that out and make it into a mosque. And as they did so, they weakened the southern wall of the Temple Mount. And that part of the wall, that's white here, that's brighter here, began to bulge outward. And there was a great fear that that wall would collapse all on its own. Luckily, no earthquakes occurred during the time when the wall was not repaired. Israel notified the Muslim authorities about it. People hemmed and hawed and hawed and hemmed, and nothing got done for many, many, many years. But finally, the Jordanians stepped in, and they repaired the bulge in the southern Temple Mount wall. And you can see that repair here. And so this wall will probably come down when this earthquake hits, because this wall is a fragile, fragile construction. And so the ancient city walls that are around some of the older cities will probably collapse as well. Let's move on to verse 21. In verse 21, we come to the results against Gog's army. And the first result is mutual killing in verse 21. I will call for a sword against him on all my mountains, declares the Lord God. Every man's sword will be against his brother. And the point here is that civil war will break out among the coalition partners, because the sword is simply a figure of speech for violent death by war, killing an enemy soldier by war. And the place of the sword attacking Gog's army is my mountains. That's the place of Gog's destruction. The means? Point two, every man's sword shall be against his brother. So here is a map of the area. And of course, here is the mountains of Jerusalem. That's where Gog will be destroyed. So the different nationalities will start fighting among themselves. Now, this is nothing new. God has used this before to protect his people. Judges 7:22, for example, 1 Samuel 14:20. Let's take a look just at 2 Chronicles 20:23 for one example of God using this as a tool. 2 Chronicles 20:23. The armies were coming against Israel, and this is what happened to them. For the sons of Ammon and Moab rose up against the inhabitants of Mount Seir. So the Ammonites and the Moabites came against the Edomites, destroying them completely. And when they had finished with the inhabitants of Seir, that's the Edomites, they helped to destroy one another. So in 2 Chronicles 20:23, the coalition of Ammonites, Moabites, and Edomites falls apart as war breaks out among the army itself. So this is a technique that God will use. We have a modern example that we have seen in our lifetime. In 1991, the United States put together a coalition of armies to, in Operation Desert Storm, to a free to go against Iraq, and it was made up of 34 nations. And one of the great fears was that this coalition would fall apart as some of these armies started fighting against each other instead of against the Iraqis. That didn't happen. And Operation Desert Storm was a success, but it was a genuine concern. All right, so that's one of the results against Gog's army, civil war, mutual killing among the armies. Another means is brought out in verse 22. With pestilence and with blood I will enter into judgment with him, and I will rain on him and on his troops and on the many peoples who are with him a torrential rain with hailstones, fire, and brimstone. Okay, so he's going to judge Gog, first of all, with pestilence. That's plagues. That's disease. And then with blood. That's just a reference for violence. To shed somebody's blood is to kill them violently. So we have disease, violence, and then a flood. I will rain an overflowing shower. And so a torrential rain will come down at this time. This is something very unusual for Israel. You don't get rains that are would be considered torrential in nature. The objects of this overflowing shower are upon him personally. Gog's going to get wet. Upon his hordes, that's his army, and upon the peoples with him, that's his coalition partners, his coalition members. Everyone's going to get almost swept away by this rainstorm. What's going to accompany the rainstorm? Point three, hailstones. That's associated with raging weather. So this torrential rainstorm is going to start high in the atmosphere, forming hailstones that crash down upon the enemy. Fire and brimstone is mentioned too. Well, this is perhaps the result of volcanic activity. That's consistent with seismic activity, with an earthquake, to have volcanic eruptions occur at the same time. So it could be a result of the earthquake, fire and brimstone being hurtled into the air, coming down on Gog. Or it could be purely supernatural. God has hurled fire and brimstone out of heaven on the enemies of his people before. So whether it be natural or whether it be supernatural, fire and brimstone is going to be part of the tools God uses to decimate the armies of Gog. In verse 23, we come to the divine purpose for this judgment. I will magnify myself, sanctify myself and make myself known in the sight of many nations, and they will know that I am the Lord. So three purposes. I will magnify myself. That means God will bring proper glory to himself. You know, he is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. He does deserve the proper credit and praise from his creation for all that he does. So he will magnify himself. He will bring proper praise to himself, praise that he is rightfully due for his grace and care of this world, and for the fact that he's not only a gracious God, but the fact that he's also a God of judgment, a God who brings the unrighteous to task. So he will magnify himself. Secondly, he says, I will sanctify myself. To sanctify something, again, is to set it apart as special so that it's no longer common. So he is going to use this destruction to set himself apart as holy and special in the eyes of the world. No more will God be taken casually or insulted. Blaspheme, that's what the word blaspheme means, to insult God. The world will see him as who he really is, absolutely holy and special. Thirdly, he says, I will make myself known in the eyes of many nations. And this refers to the Gentile nations. The Gentile nations will finally understand who it was who chose Israel and who it is who protects Israel. And it's the God of heaven, the God of heaven and earth. Psalm 121:4. They will finally learn the truth of this statement. Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. They'll finally know who protects Israel. And the result, they will know that I am, your text says, Jehovah. The Hebrew text probably reads there, Yahweh. They will know that I am Yahweh. I am the Lord, the creator of heaven and earth. Many in the Gentile nations will finally get it, finally understand what's going on here. All right, some observations. Point five. God totally destroys the invaders by both natural and possibly supernatural means. So it's God who does the judgment. It's not the IDF, not the Israeli Defense Forces. Israel does not destroy the invaders. Okay? No other nation, point B, not only is Israel unable to destroy the invaders, but no other nation is used to destroy the invaders. Mankind does not do it. The protesters do not do it. The United States does not respond with an atomic attack against Russia's coalition. A lot of people think that's what's going to happen, an atomic attack. Well, the results of the text, what we'll read in the text in just a few minutes, mitigate against that. So the Israeli Defense Forces don't do it. Mankind does not do it. And in this way, God gets the glory. So God will not use, even the USA, we're currently the most powerful nation on earth, but God will not use the USA to destroy the forces. If he did, who would get the glory? Well, the USA would get the glory. So he's not going to use us. Now, this result, this destruction of Israel's enemies, will also short-circuit a typical Israeli attitude. And again, that attitude was voiced by my friend Moshe. There is no God. That's going to take a hit. We did it. We have the power. So this prosperous, influential, confident attitude that so many Israelis have will be put aside. Many Israelis will be humbled and will seek the Lord due to this judgment upon the enemies of Israel. All right, that brings us now to from chapter 38 to chapter 39. And in chapter 39, we begin by looking at the overthrow of Gog in verses 1 through 16. So we're going to start the next chapter, and so I think that this would probably be a great place to just call it quits for right now. That we've only got a few minutes remaining anyway. I see that maybe there's 6 minutes remaining in this session. So let's go ahead and quit a little early. And we'll pick it up next session with chapter 39. And we'll look in detail at the overthrow of Gog. So we'll see you next session. Have a good day. Shalom.